My name is Chico Alvarez, and I'm the host of New World Gallery, which airs every Saturday at 3 p.m. on this station, WBAI. WBAI is listener-supported, commercial-free resistance radio. We challenge the norms and defy them. Let's break down what that really means. It means that no clandestine corporate entity can tell me how to do my show. It means that you, the listener, and the diverse WBAI community have a voice. It is a voice which reverberates across the tri-state area. But in order to keep providing you with the independent news, unique conversation, and groundbreaking arts content you rely on, we need your help. Donate by visiting givetowbai.org or pledge right now from your smartphone by texting the letters WBAI to the numbers 41444. And thank you for your support.
You're listening to Health Action over WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. I'm Catherine Davis. On today's program, I'll be joined by Katrina Taylor to welcome Onaje Mouride and Fatima Hafiz for a discussion on reweaving the fabric of our communities. Onaje and Fatima are lifelong practitioners of the healing arts and sciences with a focus on trauma release, indigenous recovery, and empowerment, sound and frequency technologies. Stay tuned.
My name is Katrina Taylor. I recently came to know of Dr. Onaje Mouride and his wife, Dr. Fatima Hafiz, after first seeing Dr. Mouride interviewed on the Philippe Jacques Mathieu's show. There was a moment towards the end of the interview where Dr. Mouride did a simple exercise with Philippe that generated this heart-expanding wave that burst from the screen that was palpable. So I had personally never experienced two people, much less two hetero men, engage in such an authentic human moment so openly and freely. It was rare and reminded me of what's truly important and sparked renewed interest in a few projects I had sitting on the shelf. So it was after that chance encounter that I discovered Dr. Mouride and Dr. Hafiz's much greater healing impact. The two of you, respectively, have spent much of your lives developing formidable skills which you've brought to issues of social welfare, trauma counseling, restorative justice, human rights, and so much more, making real differences in lives, nationally and globally.
Thank you, Katrina.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. Dr. Hafiz,
yes.
I was just looking at all that you've achieved, just the little bit that I could glean. The level of excellence you achieve in your life would require just an indomitable determination. Can you tell us a little more about what's at the heart of your ongoing ambitions and successes?
Thank you, Katrina, for the question. To be quite honest, I think it's just a love. It's a love for my people. It's a love for humanity. And I don't know if I always look at accomplishments and successes in the way that maybe others might. I have learned to just sort of be in spirit with what I'm doing, and it shows up the way that it shows up. And I think love is at the bottom of it or at the center of all the things that I do. And, of course, I'm human, So, you know, the manifestation of things may not be as clear to me in terms of getting there, just being able to be in it. So I think that what's at the bottom of it is love, love for my people, love for humanity. And my own journey actually began with love for my own family, my own children. I think that that's where it's generated from.
I can absolutely appreciate that. That's so beautiful. And I would say to you, Imagine, the same would be true of you regarding this indomitable, you know, determination to achieve your goals. What motivates you?
Well, good morning. Thank you so much for this invitation to speak with you, to be on the program, and the work you've done to bring this about. So thank you so much, Katrina. I would have to say it goes back to my childhood, in that I was raised in the backwoods. There's a song called Patches, and he says, you know, he's speaking about his life. And I kind of related to that song. Now, I didn't work as hard as Patches had to work because his father died. But I was raised in the backwoods with no running water, no plumbing. I had an outhouse to relieve myself. And but it was on the land, you know. And it was also with family. And down this dirt road was nothing but families, uncles, cousins, you know, like that. I mean, it was really something kind of weird, because if you would think of the time, I was born in 52. So if you think of the time and it being in northern New Jersey, you would say, wait a minute, how are these people living like this, you know, in a place surrounded by, not opulence, but certainly people doing very well off. But this was where we had, what they say, squatted the land, you know. And so I always had this feeling that people, that I need to be surrounded by family. I need to be surrounded by people who love me, who I love them. And that's what I was born into, and my life has been that. So my role as an activist or as a healer, social worker, has always been really, how do I create this village around me, you know? How do I create this village around me? And that, I think, has been the motivating thing, you know, all along.
I was going to ask a little bit about the organization that I believe was founded in 2006, Transformative Education Associates. The two of you are president and CEO. What kind of work do you do there?
Mm-hmm. Elijah, you want to talk a little bit about that? Or?
No, I prefer you to take the lead on that one.
Mm-hmm. So, Transformative Education Associates, the more affectionate name is, we call ourselves the T Group, T-E-A, and T-E-A stands for where we spend our time, energy, and attention is exactly what is manifested. So what it began back in 2006, actually began before then with myself being involved in moderating conversations in communities, particularly around particular issues. And I work with WHYY and University of Penn, some folk who were doing some work around looking at the mayoral election in Philadelphia a few years ago, and we would actually go into communities and create these conversations. So my work really began there and before, and a little bit before there. But the organization itself started to emerge when I realized that the work I was doing with WHYY and with University of Penn was focused on getting the voices and the opinions of folk who were not in communities that I wanted to serve. And it was good because we got a lot of information. People began to have these dialogues. And as a matter of fact, it influenced the winning of that particular mayoral election
for the mayor, and I decided that the communities that I wanted to serve, their voices are missing in a lot of places. So a couple of things happened. I became part of a project in a small city right outside of Philadelphia, and it was a project that a few of my colleagues at Temple University wanted to go in and, you know, look at what, quote, social capital looked like, and they asked if I could go in on the project. So I really respectfully had to decline because I know how universities and agencies, organizations go into communities of color, particularly the black community, and they extract information and they build their careers and, you know, they tout what they've done. And so I declined, but I gave them a proposal. And with that proposal, I said I would go in if we could go in and really create conversations where people in the community could get connected. And we weren't calling it social capital, but more work where people look at how do they thrive, how do they survive, and to talk with each other, get connected with one another in neighborhoods. And so out of that project, back in 2011, an incident happened, a violent incident, where nine young people were shot at a birthday party, and it sort of brought that city to a halt, particularly those in government, those on the ground, and so forth. So from that, we began to look at how do we hold the space for conversations of healing. And out of that, we had groups of people in a parallel conversation. And so the organization began to look at how do we begin to talk about healing in our communities that also is a reparative and restorative way of healing our communities. And within that context, the organization started to really kind of take legs. And since then, we've done quite a bit of work in charter schools around restorative practices, organizing, creating conversations for connections. And I'll just give you a little short bit about the connection piece. When we began doing dialogues in the small city, because of the way the city is very small, I mean about 4.5 square miles, and there were families. I call it a family affair, because on one side of the city, the east side of the city, the west side of the city, people have been separated by a number of reasons over time. And what they realized when they began to have these dialogues is that that's my cousin, that's my uncle, that was your grandma, that was my great-grandmother. You know, so it was like these connections starting to happen and people began to see themselves. So that's kind of what we do. I can't put it in a nutshell, but I can say that it has generated a lot of self-reflection with the community, and a lot of new generative things have started to happen in that community and with the people that we've been working with. So that's a little bit. Imagine, do you have anything you want to add to that in terms of what we do?
Well, I think that's a good foundation. And when you talked about people being reconnected and realizing that they were family, I'm sure that much of it had to do with what they experienced in Chester and, in fact, many black communities around the country. And that is, it's something that's called root shock. Mm-hmm. Dr. Fully Love, right, physician, wrote this book, Root Shock, and she showed how urban renewal, the building of all these interstate highways, just broke up families, broke up communities. I mean, just all over the country. So it wasn't just that what happened in Chester. It really happened all over the place. But let's understand, it's how we're being constantly assaulted from the outside. So what T does is to try to bring people together, create a space. In fact, On our card, we have the quote, "From empty spaces to healing spaces." So we facilitate conversations, interpersonal, couples, families, communities. When we first went into Chester, Fatima had spoken about that invitation that she got. She redefined her relationship and really defined the whole project. And we put together something called "How Are the Children?" And "How Are the Children?" Was focused on, we used three African greetings. One from South Africa, "I see you," right? And a response is, "I am here." The second was the Dogon, who say, "God sent you," right? "How was your health?" And then the last one is from the Maasai. When they greet each other, they ask the question, "How are the children?" So we use those three African greetings as philosophical groundings and statements to engage the conversation of a town that is, you know, primarily, you know, people of African descent. So we look at people, communities, in historical context. And to do that is to then really understand that our people are suffering, our people are in pain, and we're in pain from historical trauma. Not historical trauma as something that happened in the past, but something that started a long time ago and still is occurring today. And that historical trauma is understanding trauma that is passed down from one generation to the next. So that's the, I guess, the bigger picture of it, how we understand our work and therefore our healing.
Yeah. And the idea, the last greeting, "How are the children," is certainly not just about how are our children right now and for people to really answer honestly about that. But it's like, how is our future? You know, in indigenous cultures, the philosophy is that we plan for seven generations out. And if we as a collective community can't be in the space of our own healing, creating the space for our own healing, then it's true that our children, how are they, may not look so well. And so this is how we've come to where we are now. And please know that what we do can't be encapsulated in a small conversation like this, but it definitely, all the elements and pieces of it are very present in everything that we do, particularly as it relates to understanding trauma, understand historical context and the nature of our cultural evolution, and understanding who we are and why we are have to take ownership of our own healing.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I love the greetings, the different cultures. Adding those to the mix is just very grounding, as you said. And also the T, tell me again, that was time, energy, and?
Attention.
Attention. It's so vital what you're bringing, so many historical fractures, as you mentioned, complete and total fractures of communities and families. It really does take a village to raise a child, but also it takes a village to grow the village, and so much of that has been lost through these historical traumas. And so the work you're doing is so valuable. It continues to be, has been, and continues to be. Catherine, did you have any questions for Nadia?
Yeah, I do. Thank you. I was listening with great interest because I believe that what you're talking about is a key to turning around the effect, you know, the impact of a lot of this trauma. But as you were speaking of the trauma and the separation of our community, I'm wondering if you can speak to how a person is separated within themselves from their true nature or from their true abilities to connect. Because what I have been finding is that people are divided against themselves, and the trauma sort of reaches in to a point where people can even sabotage themselves or not be able to get beyond issues of self-esteem. And when that happens, it ends up manifesting as disdain for self and disdain for anyone who looks like self. If you would be able to speak to healing that part of the trauma.
Oh, okay.
And I think if you want to speak to that, I do have a thought, but go ahead.
Okay. I would go back to Emeco Cabral, who was the revolutionary leader of PAIGC, the Revolutionary Movement in Guinea-Bissau, in Cape Verde Islands. And he says that the oppressor has to commit genocide or has to commit cultural genocide, one or the other. So when you remove people from their culture, which is affirming as well as challenging in terms of pushing you forward, when you remove people from the culture that they create out of their own consciousness and relationship to the universe, axiology, right? When you remove people from their own natural space and own natural way of relating to the universe, you automatically affect them in a negative way. And the experience that people of African descent has had, and that is coupled, you know, with Native, because we're indigenous, we're both. When you look at our experiences, you can see centuries of harmful, what is called seasoning. So, how we think of ourselves, you know, I ask people, why is it that you can go to every black person in America, in the United States of America, and they always know the answer to this, using the N-word ain't something else, right? One, two, three. N-word ain't another word, right? You can go all around the country, and every black person will know that. Like, how is it that we all know that out of all the things that we know, right, in common? So it's been this constant seasoning that has started certainly centuries ago, but it's being passed down from one generation to the next, and then it becomes an induced culture. So that most of the things which we are living is not really ours. It's someone else's imprint, someone else's intent. So the healing begins with what is called Sankofa. Sankofa is going back and fetch what you've lost, going back and retrieve what you've lost. Recovery is regaining something that was lost, stolen, or given away. So our people are in the process of Sankofa right now, returning to our original selves, our original ideas of who we are and who we are to be in the world. So that's, you know, I would say that it's really a process of recovering ourselves, which is called Sankofa. Fatima?
Yeah, Catherine, I think that was a really good question as it relates to the internal dynamic and internal processes that has to happen with the heart. There are three things that I want to just address in relationship to what does it take for people to connect within. And one of the things I want to say is that I think aloneness, meaning feeling alone, even though you see that all around you, maybe people are experiencing certain things, but there's this loneliness inside that really doesn't honor the sense of what your heart's desire is, what your heart is calling for. And many times the heart has become veiled by the very things, some of the things that Anajay talked about, but by some of the things that we have developed over time. So the aloneness is one way that we find ourselves disconnected. Even if we're around 1,000 people, you know, you have great entertainers who have had many people around them and people who show, quote, love for them. But there's this sense of aloneness. So that's one, in terms of being able to connect, that sense of aloneness. Two, it's difficult for us to find mirrors for ourselves, to look in another's eyes and see that we are the same, yet we're different. So that sense of not being able to see ourselves is another challenge in relationship to the internal disconnection. And one of the ways that I've found in the work that we have been doing, that we're doing, is that when people share their stories, when there's a space created, where people share their stories and we can hold the space for the conflict that happens externally, we can also begin to help to cultivate how to be with the conflicts that's happening internally, so that our heart, our head, and our gut are feeling or knowing the direction for ourselves. Knowing that we're not alone is where our stories, when we share our stories with one another, and not just the stories that, you know, people want to hear, but those deep stories that have impacted us. You know, people, I remember my great-grandmother, my great-grandmother raised me. And I remember going to my great-aunt and starting to ask questions about their experience. And, you know, what they would say is, oh, leave that alone, leave that alone. So they've never had the space to even talk about it. And they, too, shut it down. And one of the challenges with historical trauma is that that internal shutting down keeps us also disconnected, not just disconnected from ourselves, but disconnected from each other. And then the last thing I want to say around that internal dynamic is the validation of our experiences. When we have an experience, and I'm going to talk just a second about emotions. So in Western culture, Western society, we have this suppression of our emotions, and it is part of what Western culture or European culture has had to do. It's like a fear of the emotional quality of our lives. Some of the Sufi work that I'm a student of Sufism, and there are five domains of our existence that help us to really start to, and this is not just germane to, you know, Sufi studies, Buddhist studies, Christian, you know, in an esoteric way, Judaism, many cultures have this understanding about how, you know, we relate in the world as human beings. And so the five domains have to do with the mental domain, the emotional domain, the physical domain, the spiritual domain, and the relational domain. So when we take those five domains and we put them in front of us as a collective, because the one thing I want to kind of get away from is that the things that we address inside is not, you know, this culture also is an individualistic culture, but many people of color or other cultures realize that it is a collective culture, and this collectiveness is where our healing takes place. It's not an individual therapy, although we can use individual therapy to help us get past some individual things, to help us kind of get centered sometimes. But really, our centeredness comes from our collective relationship, how we help each other to deal with not only the internal dynamics that we're experiencing, but also the external. And part of that is our fear of conflict. Conflict is a natural human thing. You know, we're in conflict when I have to make a decision whether I'm going to do this for my child or that for my other child. And so we're always making these decisions in somewhat of a, quote, conflict way. But as our, in our community, we're healing internal and external had to happen. There's no room, there's no space for that conflict to emerge so that we can see something new. So I think what you ask in relationship to the heart and what does it take for the heart to see itself is the mirror, the validation, and the sense that we're not alone in the struggles we have internally.
If I can continue with that thought.
Yes, please.
Yeah, Fatima had said, you know, being alone. The European paradigm is, I think, therefore I am. Which is silly. It makes no sense. The African affirmation of life is, I am because we are, and because we are, therefore I am. So we always are looking at those relationships, being together. And with that, we know that oppression happens through the accomplishment of three objectives: making the people ahistorical, making the people apolitical, and making them afuturistic. So why is it our children are saying, I'm not going to live to be 30, I'm not going to live to be 20? Why are indigenous people on reservations committing suicide at the age of 9 in packs? is because they have no idea of the future. In fact, they say there's no future for them here on this thing, this planet called Earth. So our work in terms of making to go against a historical piece is that we have to understand our identity. That's a healing process. In fact, Emeka Cabral had wrote a piece called History, you know, is a Weapon. When Goebbels, the brain behind Nazi propaganda, heard culture being discussed, he brought out his revolver and just shot people. That's how important culture is. When you meant to offset being apolitical, it's helping people realize the power in their lives right now in terms of the decisions they're making. And as far as being afuturistic, it's that's direction. So we're talking about identity, purpose, and direction. But this, as Fatima pointed out, this requires a process that is called retreat. Retreat is all the different, you know, spiritual paths and traditions, wisdom traditions, have always understood that you had to remove yourself from the environment that's making you sick. And you have to be in a place where you can start to release the tension, release the stress, release the daily things that's going on with your life so that you can re-center yourself, reestablish yourself. So retreat is a very important spiritual practice that all traditions use, and we see this as a practice, right, as a methodology that we can use. So we have been blessed with this vision of hosting a retreat. It's called Healing Ourselves, Healing Our Communities, Harmonizing Retreat with Dr. Randy Weston. That's coming up on September 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. So the work we do is really understand how do we move from empty places to healing spaces, and we know that one of the greatest healing space that we can be in is in nature. So this is what is called the Sufi Echo Retreat Center. That's up in the Berkshires Shores, not too far from Pittsfield, Massachusetts, right on the line, in fact, in a small town called New Lebanon, New York. And for those of you who may not know who Dr. Randy Weston is, he's a phenomenal human being, spiritualist. You know, I don't know if he ever identified himself as a Sufi, but certainly he is living a Sufi life. And his music is so healing, rooted in Africa, but it's international. And that's a retreat that's right in front of us that we're really hoping that you and your listeners will be able to attend.
Well, I'd like to hear a little bit more about that, but how will people connect with you to find out about your retreat?
They can email us at IAMHealing, that's I-A-M, then the space, underscore, healing, AOL.com. Or they can also they can call me at 646-662-0217. And because we know that many people may not have the funds to actually come to the retreat, we have started a GoFundMe page. So if people went to the website GoFundMe, and if they put in the name Randy Weston, W-E-S-T-O-N, it will take you to a site that says a picture of myself and Dr. Hafiz under Healing Ourselves, Healing Our Communities. So we're doing everything we can to get the word out, to encourage support. Even if people can't come, if they make a contribution, they're still a part of the process. Because sometimes we think that we have to be someplace physically to be a part of it, which is really just not true. We have to be a part of it philosophically, spiritually, as well as physically. And all those things working together will, in fact, create a successful event, whatever that may be. So those are I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to say people also can go to The Abode, T-H-E, Abode, A-B-O-D-E, D as in David, E, at theabode.org. And go to programs, and they will see a listed with, and they can also register if they choose to register, and they can also get a little bit more background and information. And what we are clear about is that this is really to bring together people who are healers, who claim the ability to be healers or healers in our community, and we're bringing these healers of color, people of color, who can be in the experience of healing themselves by being present to their own suffering. They're able to more effectively be more effective, life-affirming and self-determining in the service they provide for our communities. And we recognize that healers of color are under-recognized even in our own communities. So what this event will do is bring them together in a sacred space to honor their own experience and connect with each other and provide support and offer them resources to bring back to the community. So I just wanted to say that they can already go and register. It's going to be limited space for the numbers, and it's all-inclusive food for those 3 days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Food and housing is included in the cost, and it's a program for healers of all spiritual traditions, so it's not any single spiritual tradition that you have to be.
Beautiful. So can one of you also briefly tell us what people will experience for those 3 days? Yes. And I think it's really important because one of the things that occurs very often with people who are healers, whether they're physicians or energy healers or practitioners of another kind of healing, they and we very seldom take the time to address whatever's going on within ourselves and in our own lives. And one of the drawbacks of that is that some very talented and capable healers often develop illnesses because they're not addressing their own needs and giving that energy out. So I really do think that keeping this balance is paramount for all of
Absolutely.
Us who think of ourselves as healers and helpers. So
Absolutely.
I appreciate that. Go ahead, Kimi, you wanted to share something?
Yes. So I'm Fatima. And
Fatima.
Yes. So some of the things we experience, we are going to be looking at the critical issues facing those practitioners. And that will be, and also the practitioner exchanges and them beginning to connect with one another. It would also be an open space, sort of an open space technology to allow people to go where they most need to share and to identify what their needs are. We also will have, you know, some workshops, not workshops in the general sense of what we think about workshops, but where it's sort of an organic process where people will start to make the connection between their own suffering and then start sharing their stories with one another by understanding what are they facing, what challenges they have going into our communities, but mostly what challenges they're having with themselves. So I appreciate what you said about those who consider themselves healers, you know, tend not to take care of themselves in terms of what they offer. So our desire is for those who are in the space that they can also offer some of their healing practices to those who are also healers. So there's an exchange. So those are some of the things they can expect. And, of course, we are going to have Dr. Weston and some of his wisdom around music and sound, and he would be in conversation with Pierre Azia Inayat Khan, who is the leader of the Inayat Order of Sufis, because we'll have exposure to that conversation, and that's going to be a larger public conversation, but the retreat itself is specifically for those practitioners to help create what they need in that space. So that's some of the things they can expect. And we can also send you more information about that, Catherine.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. I think it's really a welcome opportunity for people to engage in this way. And actually, we're very close to being out of time. So I would love for you to once again give that email and phone number that's easiest for people to grasp so that they can make that connection and you can send them all the details. So, Dr. Nasher, would you be willing to give that out again?
Yes. I am healing at AL.com and then also 646-662-0217. This happens to be an auspicious time in that the International Black Summit is taking place in Guyana. I just want to give them a big shout out because they've been doing some phenomenal work for many years. They started in, I think, about 1991. And if you go to their website, theblacksummit.org, you can even virtually be connected to the work that they're doing. And it's really, it's calling the healers together for us to say, how are you doing, healer? Right? What do you need? How can we figure this out? How can we heal together? And that's really the center of it. And at the center of that is this person who's done that his whole life. Dr. Randy Weston is 91 years old.
Okay.
This is an opportunity we do not want to miss.
Okay, so I just want to give that email address again. It's IAM_healing@AOL.com and the phone number 646-662-0217. Excellent. And Katrina, why don't you...
Thank you so much. And thank you, Anaji and Fatima. It's so true, everything you're bringing to the table, the dynamics of self-affirmation, this need for community, fears of conflict, and the internalized, often engineered fears, you know, that I've really experienced down here in Georgia during the Trump era, these projected, internalized fears. Which is why what you're bringing is so vital right now. And I'm experiencing that healing heart wave again on this call and all the beautiful information you brought. I look forward to the retreat. And thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Small boy walked down the city street. Hope was in his eyes as he searched the faces of the people he'd meet for one he could recognize. Brother, where are you? They said. As hard as stone, the poor boy whimpered and began to cry because he was all alone. is called. Hold me.
this hour, in my deepest despair, will you still care? Will you be there? In my trials and my tribulations, through our doubts and frustrations, in my violence, in my turbulence, through my fear and my confessions, in my anguish and my pain, through my joy and my sorrow, in the promise of another tomorrow, I'll never let you part.
I see them smile through faces of people I don't know. I hear them in the music on my radio. Wisdom of the winds, faces in the clouds, rhythm of the rains, oh mountain standing proud. Prepare me for a special place. Tell me I've no time to waste. Challenge me to face my life's request. Encourage me to do my best. Everywhere I go and everything I see, flying in the air, speaking truth through me. I am a curious spirit child who fell to earth through a crack of lightning. But God, so kind and merciful, sent old souls to guide me on. Yeah. Power.
I said sarcastically, pardon that squeaking, I said sarcastically, tell me it's done because it's only 12:58 and I'm still getting my act together, which ain't on the road. But it was done. I was right. So, somebody tell me it's done. This is WBAI in New York City. How professional. Listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio. Broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Heart of Mind was brought to you on recording. Hour of the Wolf is coming up in, 30 seconds or so, as soon as I do the stuff with the computer that I need to do. No, I was going to do a Facebook Live. I did a Facebook Live last week, and a whole lot of it, by the way, was like, you know, sideways. You know, it went portrait when it should have gone landscape. And it was actually, I have to say, quite a bit of fun. But it was also, to a large extent, like a... I see. I have to go into a particular app. It was like doing a two-hour selfie. You know, just having the phone look at me, and most of the show was on recording, so I could just look at the phone and talk to people. And lo and behold, they were able to get back to me. And... yes, I'm trying to sign in from another computer. It's the same one I sign in from once a week, every week, you stupid Google. That's my brand new phone you just heard. But I have to admit, it was a lot of fun. But I left my glasses at home. I left my little tripod at home. I haven't tried this yet with a guest, which makes a lot more sense than just me. But we will, in the future, be doing a lot of experimentation with Facebook Live. I don't think Periscope. I am not really enamored of Periscope at all. I must say that's Twitter's
family. Matt Walsh and Michaela Watkins are his parents. Ryan Simpkins is the sister they had after his disappearance. One of the things that stands in the way of James's assimilation
is
the psychic roadblock that the unfinished adventures of his beloved bear has formed. So with the help of some of his newfound friends, including a sensitive cop played by Greg Kinnear, James resolves to shoot a film that will add the final chapter to Grigsby Bear's adventures and provide a conduit past the damage done on his abduction. Next time is the 13.8
rear-facing MF camera.
And you know how this scenario is usually handled.
So,
guy emerges from captivity and just cannot cope. Think blast from the past or being there. But director Dave McCarry, who makes his feature film debut here and who worked at Saturday Night Live.
At once broadcasting? Thank you for telling me. Let me put on the headphones, which actually aren't playing me anything. Let me see. Okay, I suspect that one of those two things is now gone. And hopefully I am the other. And I am the other. In case nobody knew that, I am the other. I think it's a Chaim Podok book, isn't it? It's a movie with Nicole Kidman. It's one of those things. Matt, if that isn't the case, please come back and let me know. I think it's high time that I started my show, don't you? Wait a second.
Escape plan. We're not reliving the will-crushing...
Oh, look at that. Yes, it's not only two things at once. What? Okay, this is not somebody else screwing up. Because I always like to have somebody else screwing up. This is me totally. Thank you. Thank you, Matt. This is me totally screwing up. Because what the other thing that was on the air was what you are about to hear. Only now, it will be on time.
Ooh.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Well, imagine that we started the show properly, but anyway, my guest this morning, Stan Brown, will be reading from his new collection of short stories, and we'll be talking about various things. So stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I'm going to admit to a heresy. Round about the halfway point of Ponyo, one of Hayao Miyazaki's later animated films, I said to myself, you know, I kind of wish this had a bad guy somewhere. That flies in the face of everything we're supposed to love about Miyazaki. His films thrive on the notion that there is no clear-cut good or evil, that even if there are adversaries, they have their reasons and can, at the very least, be empathized with, maybe even liked. But you can push the needle too far in the I'm okay, we're all okay direction, and I had hit that mark with this film. The new film, Brigsby Bear, which is presently playing theatrically in New York, lists Andy Samberg as one of its many, many producers. Andy Samberg also happens to be the star of the cop sitcom Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and one of the production companies of that show, Lord Miller, is also one of the concerns behind Brigsby Bear. Now, given the all-hands-on-deck nature of both film and TV production, Brigsby Bear lists no less than 17 producers, associate producers, executive producers, etc., including Lord Miller's Phil Lord and Christopher Miller. It's hard to draw clear lines of influence from one project to another. But I think it's significant to note that Brooklyn Nine-Nine takes a very Miyazaki-esque approach to its topic matter. All the staff in the fictional 9-9 precinct are lovable in their own way. Even the lowest of criminal scum tend to have their adorable aspects. And that outlook has translated to Brigsby Bear. Sandberg even shows up in a supporting role as a rebellious psychiatric hospital resident who's something like if Randall McMurphy was rewritten as a lovable goof. Why that is interesting is that that attitude gently subverts expectations of what Brigsby Bear is supposed to be. The film centers on James Pope, a young man played by Kyle Mooney, who also co-wrote the script, who was kidnapped as a child by a mad toy designer and his educator wife, played by Mark Hamill and Jane Addams, and held in isolation, believing his kidnappers to be his actual parents and the world around him to have been destroyed in some kind of nuclear or environmental apocalypse. The high point of his days of captivity is the arrival of video cassettes containing his favorite show, Brigsby Bear Adventures, a serialized epic actually produced by his captors, featuring a guy in a bear suit who has sci-fi adventures with a pair of twin girls, while also delivering rather sophisticated educational challenges and providing important tips on isolation shelter upkeep. When James is finally rescued and restored to his real family, Matt Walsh and Michaela Watkins are his parents, Ryan Simpkins is the sister they had after his disappearance. One of the things that stands in the way of James's assimilation is the psychic roadblock that the unfinished adventures of his beloved bear has formed. So with the help of some of his newfound friends, including a sensitive cop played by Greg Kinnear, James resolves to shoot a film that will add the final chapter to Brigsby Bear's adventures and provide a conduit past the damage done by his abduction. And you know how this scenario is usually handled. Guy emerges from captivity and just cannot cope. Think Blast from the Past or Being There. But director Dave McCary, who makes his feature film debut here and who worked at Saturday Night Live previously, presumably with both Sandberg and Mooney, tries for something that holds closer to emotional truth. James isn't a disaster area after his ordeal, and the people around him, mostly teenagers, having seen his story covered quite thoroughly in the media, are quick to appreciate the adjustments he's going through. Even the girl who tries to give him his first sexual experience reacts to his subsequent freakout with less offense and more bemusement. The film is not a bleak indictment of the crushing impact the world has on true innocence, but a gentle exploration of one person's efforts to move on and how his process binds others to him. Even when a misunderstanding has James involuntarily committed to a psychiatric hospital, a chapter that comes complete with the requisite nocturnal escape plan, we're not reliving the will-crushing scenarios of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. The doctors may not understand James, but there's no malevolence in their efforts, and James does seem to benefit. What McCary has done, and it's no small trick, is to balance comedy with a positive outlook without losing the credibility of either his characters or his scenario. Even when Kinnear's cop demonstrates a hidden longing for life on the stage, it plays as deeply held and endearing, rather than as indie film quirky. There may be some who will still find Brigsby Bear a little too cloying. I'm kind of sensitive to that stuff myself, but the sweet comedy of Brigsby Bear did not step over that line for me, and I appreciated the sunny feeling it left me with. And just a quick thing. If ever there was a poster child for the corporate blockbuster movie, it'd be Kong Skull Island, which is now available for rental on demand. The director, Jordan Vogt Roberts, has only had brief flirtations with genre in his prior career, none of which indicate a particular interest in kaiju, of which Skull Island is clearly an Americanized rendition. The script could have been written by the McKee-Otronic 5000, so religious is it in adhering to the commercial template. It gets to the point that when John C. Reilly shows up as a slightly loopy aviator who's been stranded on the island since World War II, you go, well, of course. And you know what? I loved it. Despite its flaws, of which there are many, I loved it. This is a real 11-year-old's notebook of a movie with the kind of moments that avid tweens scrawl into the ruled margins. Kong swatting down helicopters, Kong vanquishing a giant squid, Kong in a life-or-death battle with an Hieronymus Boschish lizard. Basically, they took the images that play in that kid's head and faithfully transposed it to the screen. I take a dim view of CG effects, but they earn their keep here, and it's gorgeous and also fun. I wasn't the kind of kid who obsessed over the prospect of giant monster battles, but Kong Skull Island made me feel like I could have been.